This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Who are we when faced with widespread contagion? Disease and humanity's wide-ranging responses to sickness are on full display in cinema. Two films in particular have been trending during the COVID-19 pandemic, Contagion and Outbreak.
The animals are contagious. The infection is in their blood and saliva. One bite.
Major cities in all parts of the country, New York, Los Angeles, report plague victims falling dead in the streets, in their homes.
You got 19 dead, you got hundreds more infected, and it's spreading like a brush fire. You got to isolate the sick.
I may be entirely wrong about the whole matter, but I've seen this disease work. And I'm telling you, if it ever gets loose,
all right, General,
spread over
this
the entire...
This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways. Stay in your homes. Stay in your homes.
She's pregnant.
Yeah, I know. It's a miracle, isn't it?
Today, for our latest installment on Movies on the Radio, we will get some help dissecting the ways filmmakers portray how humanity copes with disease. I'm joined, of course, by our two resident film experts. Laura Boyes is a film curator for the North Carolina Museum of Art and the curator of the Movie Diva series. Hey, Laura.
Hey, Anita.
And Marcia Gordon, a film professor at North Carolina State University and a National Humanities Center fellow. Hey, Marcia.
Hi, Anita.
And I'm also excited for Priscilla Wald to be joining us. She's a professor of English at Duke University and the author of Contagious Cultures, Carriers, and the Outbreak Narrative. Hey, Priscilla.
Hi, Anita.
So we're all practicing social distancing well. You all are joining me remotely, so I can't see your faces. A different kind of Movies on the Radio today. But
Indeed. Alas,
let's just start with this question of why on earth we all want to watch movies about disease spreading in this moment when we're already anxiety-ridden enough with the news. Marcia, let's start for you. Why do you think these films are surging in popularity?
Well, first off, I don't think everybody does want to do this. As a matter of fact, I would say there's probably a pretty strong split between people who want to consume things that make them not think about this because we're so inundated right now. I mean, it's very hard to not be glued to internet news outlets or however you're getting your news. And so, but the people who are drawn to this, I think it's partly because people are looking for not answers. These are not educational films, although in some cases there are CDC consultants, for example, who try to steer the scientific content to be responsible. And therefore they do have some kind of relationship to reality. But because I think we've always turned to media narratives to help understand the world around us. And in some ways, we want to look at a film like Contagion because it's like, wow, this is eerily predictive. This is so relevant. If this was something that somebody was making a movie about in 2011 or in 2005 or in 1999, why aren't we more prepared for this?
Yeah, Laura, how about you?
Well, someone in The Guardian described it as emergency preparedness for the mind, that you watch these things unfold on screen and you see the worst case scenario because these are extremely fear-provoking movies. And you can sort of get to the point where you think that maybe you would be able to cope, although watching some of these things, you know, I defy the individual to say that they could cope. But it's also that these movies often use this disease as a metaphor. You know, it's the communists, it's capitalism, it's the government, it's globalization. But then when we have a real pandemic, it's not a metaphor. It's something that's actually happening. So it's a lot harder to kind of categorize it in our mind.
Priscilla, I want to get your thoughts as well, but I want to play a quick clip first to give people who maybe haven't seen these movies a sense of what we're talking about. So here is a clip from Contagion.
Biggest shopping weekend of the year.
I think we need to consider closing schools down.
And who stays home with the kids? People that work at stores, government workers, people that work at hospitals. When will we know what this is? What causes it? What cures it? Things that keep people calm.
What we need to determine is this. For every person who gets sick, how many other people are they likely to infect? So, for seasonal flu, that's usually about one. Smallpox, on the other hand, it's over three. Now, before we had a vaccine, polio spread at a rate between four and six. Now, we call that number the R-naught. R stands for the reproductive rate of the virus.
Any ideas what that might be for this?
How fast it multiplies depends on a variety of factors. The incubation period, how long a person is contagious. Sometimes people can be contagious without even having symptoms. We need to know that too. And we need to know how big the population of people susceptible to the virus might be.
So far, that appears to be everyone with hands, a mouth, and a nose.
Once we know the R-naught, we'll be able to get a handle on the scale of the epidemic.
That's a clip from the 2011 film Contagion. That is a movie clip. I am here with Priscilla Wald, Laura Boyes, and Marcia Gordon talking about cinema's portrayal of disease today on Movies on the Radio. And y'all can hop in on the conversation with the hashtag SOTMovie. So Priscilla, when I saw that clip of Contagion this weekend, that felt very, very real to me. I felt like I could have been watching TV news. So talk about kind of where Contagion gets things right and wrong in terms of the portrayal of an outbreak.
Oh, sure. And also, I think it explains why people are so drawn to these films, because they're drawn to them even when there's not a pandemic going on. They're medical mysteries. They're thrillers. There's a fight for really the fate of humanity between the microbe and epidemiologists and medical scientists and so on. And ultimately, the medical science wins, epidemiology wins, there's a vaccine, things are contained, and the problem is solved, and humanity can begin to recover. So there's almost a sense of renewal about it and reassurance, where I think the CDC actually was pretty positive about this film and said, yes, this is the kind of infrastructural collapse we could expect to see, people fighting in parking lots over things like toilet paper. That's the kind of thing that would happen. I found two particular problems with the film, or really three that I would talk about. And one is that while sure a lot of people would be selfish and fighting with each other and panicked and there'd be chaos, I think there'd also be a lot more good in the world than that film shows. So that was one concern I had about the film. What about the more positive sides of humanity? They were sparse in that film. They were there. But
yeah,
were
I mean, it really does kind of pull our society under the microscope. I went straight from watching that film into Costco, and I was like, well, people in Costco right now are not being as crazy as portrayed in Contagion, but, you know, maybe it could get worse. Maybe the hoarding could get worse, which is kind of a symptom of going to Costco generally. But I wonder, you know, Marcia, what do you think about this, you know, the hoarding, the profiteering, the conspiracy theories that come up in Contagion, these somewhat problematic responses that we can have to these outbreaks?
Well, I think there's two things that are interesting in Contagion with regard to that. One is there's a character in the film played by Jude Law who is basically selling a fake cure and profiteering off of people's desperation and wish for a faster solution to the problem. But the reason that character is able to do what he does is because there's this lag time between the scientists trying to solve the problem and actually solving the problem. And that raises this question of class and privilege, which is very much, I think, at the fore today, which is when this vaccine is developed, who will have access to it? I mean, we only get a small glimpse, I think, of the economic impacts in Contagion, the looting and such. But there is this larger question that the film raises about, like, who is going to get a cure first? Is it going to be the privileged, the wealthy, the politically connected? Yes, it will be. And so then what does that mean when you have this kind of class resentment that's already, those are the most fragile people in society who are going to suffer the most, are the people who are living paycheck to paycheck. And so this film is also, I think, dealing with those questions, which are pretty serious societal questions that we face right now.
Let's listen to another quick clip from Contagion.
I thought you said that once we could grow it, we could vaccinate against it.
We tried using dead virus combined with several adjuvants to boost immune response.
And?
No protective antibodies, a lot of dead monkeys.
Can you get to the part where there's good news?
Now we have to try a live attenuated virus.
Like with polio?
Exactly. The only danger with a live virus is the possibility that it will revert to wild type and kill the host.
When will we know about that?
I'll ask the monkeys.
That's another clip from the 2011 film Contagion. I'm here with Priscilla Wald, Laura Boyes, and Marcia Gordon for Movies on the Radio. So, Laura, what about that in Contagion? I mean, it kind of shows you the uncertainty of even what the scientists are dealing with, and the uncertainty is something that many of us are struggling with right now.
Absolutely. Also, I wanted to bring up the fact that there was a huge article in the New York Times this Sunday about the gigantic earthquake in Alaska in the 1960s and how they expected it to have that dystopian disaster movie kind of trajectory where there would be, you know, looting and hoarding and people fighting in the streets. And they sent people out there to document that. But what in fact happened was that communities pulled together and helped each other. And people who had nothing were really the most empathetic in many ways to others who were also suffering. And all of these pandemic movies show, you know, the empty store shelves and the people roaming the streets with guns, but they really don't see the fact that many people are not selfish and actually care about their neighbors and their community.
So I want to turn now to the other movie that is top of mind for many people, and this is Outbreak. This is a 1995 film, a lot of interesting things to contrast between Outbreak and Contagion. So let's start with a quick clip.
Mataba is only spread through direct human contact. Now, you said that yourself, Sam.
I know what I told you, but now I'm telling you we're facing a new strain.
What?
It spreads like the flu.
Impossible.
Fine. Go to the hospital, check it out yourself. Go without a mask, you'll see more clearly. You got 19 dead, you got hundreds more infected, and it's spreading like a brush fire. You gotta isolate the sick, and I mean really isolate them, Billy. We gotta get everybody else back into their houses. We gotta keep them there.
We're doing that, Sam.
No, we're not doing it because I just drove through 100 people. And if one of them has got it, then 10 of them have got it. And if you're going to arrest me now.
All right, Sam, all right.
Don't threaten me. Don't threaten my crew. Please. Leave us to do our work.
That's a clip from Outbreak, starring Morgan Freeman and Dustin Hoffman. And we are talking about it on Movies on the Radio today as we're digging into narratives of disease. So, Priscilla, I want to go to you on this one. You mentioned a bit earlier kind of the heroic individualism that we tend to see a lot in these films. Tell me about how you think Outbreak fits into that narrative.
Oh, Outbreak definitely fits into that narrative. Dustin Hoffman's character is a crusader, and he's going to go up against the government, he's going to go up against the military, he's going to go up against all the odds, and he's going to solve the problem with one monkey and produce vaccine for countless people, which is not possible. but it's heroic and wonderful, and we're all reassured. So, you know, again, I think that there's a really interesting struggle between that to me reaches mythic proportions between the terrifying microbe and nature and medical science and epidemiology, which will save us. And to me, the problem with that narrative is that it doesn't get at the larger issues of why we're in this kind of problem in the first place and what we really how we ought to be thinking about it, which is problems of development, globalization, global poverty. The biggest single vector that will turn an outbreak into a pandemic is global poverty. Why aren't we talking about that, anticipating that, putting money now into infrastructure that will be both more humanitarian and more economically sound in the long term?
Well, right. I mean, this film really shows us that no matter how individualistic we may feel, we are all so interconnected. We cannot help but have a monkey come over and transmit a disease. We're constantly in trade and communication all around the world. So the idea of kind of just focusing on our nation really doesn't work. Laura, what stands out to you about how that's portrayed in this film?
Well, we crave heroes in our movies. We want somebody to step in and solve all our problems. And another reason that the current real-life outbreak doesn't match up to these cinematic ones is that where is our hero? Where is the person, you know, somewhere in medicine or government that's speaking up as if they have a grasp of the entire problem and have a solution for us? I mean, I don't really see that. I don't think Dustin Hoffman in real life is going to step up and do that for us.
Well, yeah. I mean, it shows you how much we really crave leadership in this moment. We crave a narrative that we can cling on to. And it can get really dangerous when that narrative is kind of tinged with racialized language and, you know, things that are going to reinforce particular stereotypes. So talk about that, Marsha, and maybe how, you know, Outbreak is pretty unabashed in its xenophobia. What does it remind you of what's happening today?
Well, actually, I'd like to shift that a little bit in relationship to Outbreak, because sure. I think what's most important about that film is that it's the U.S. government's quest for a biological weapon that creates this whole problem. So that makes this film really different, because it's like the Army and CDC scientists who are saving the day, and they have to fight the government to get that. And so now it's not a question of like, we're all in this together, let's solve this problem, the government and scientists. It's this idealized world. And you know, this film is kind of forecasting a scenario in which the government is actually at odds with science. Imagine that. Although this is a much more nefarious plot. So I think that that's one of the important contributions Outbreak makes to this whole kind of genre.
Certainly. All right, let's go back to some of the early days of film, Marsha. I know you're really interested in these early portrayals of tuberculosis. One of them is this really sweet 12-minute silent film, Falling Leaves, which I enjoyed. It really brought my heart rate down. So take us back to some of these early portrayals.
Okay, so cinema is coming of age in the 1910s. Storytelling is getting more and more sophisticated. And this is also a time at which the nation and, you know, the world is trying to deal with the spread of tuberculosis. And so Alice Guy Blaché, one of the pioneering women directors, made a film called Falling Leaves. And it's a lovely consumption-themed melodrama, if you can imagine that, consumption referring to tuberculosis. And it starts with a young woman with a cough, and the doctor tells the family she's not going to make it through fall, and she has this adorable little sister who happens to meet a doctor who's working on a cure while she's out in the front yard one day, and it ends with this romantic coupling in the end, and the young woman is cured because of the doctor's intervention. And this film has no educational component. It's just a movie, right? It's just a story. But the New York Board of Censorship was really outraged by this film because it showed a patient who was not quarantined, who was sick enough to be spreading the disease, who should have been isolated. The younger sister, who gets coughed on in the movie, would most certainly have gotten tuberculosis. And it also gave the illusion that there was a cure to tuberculosis, which of course was not the case until the 1940s. And so this is an interesting instance early on, I think, of a film that was just using disease as a storytelling device, but was accused of using it irresponsibly. And there were, of course, other films being made at the time that were trying to use tuberculosis in narrative films to actually teach people about how it was spread, about coughing, about sharing cups and things like that. And so, in other words, film has a long history of engaging with disease as a narrative strategy, and also in order to teach people about its spread.
Yeah, and there's sweet moments of humanity in that film. Yes. I think, you know, the younger sister, they hear that, you know, your sister will die when all the leaves fall from the trees. So then she decides she's going to pick up all the leaves and put them back on the trees. it's so cute.
It's an extraordinarily artful and moving film that also happens to have a kind of irresponsible medical message in it. So it's kind of an interesting example of the way those two things have to be handled rather carefully.
Well, at that period of time, people dealt with so many plagues. I mean, it was not unusual for families to have children die, not just of tuberculosis, but of diphtheria or whooping cough or measles or things that now are prevented by vaccines. Venereal disease was a huge plague before the invention of sulfa drugs. And there were other silent films that talked in very veiled terms, of course, about the spread of venereal disease, which also was a quite controversial way of dealing with a plague.
All right, let's move to 1950, Panic in the Streets. I'll play a clip of this film noir film.
If you want to believe the doctor here, I'm sorry, sir, but frankly, I honestly don't. But if you want to believe him, there's only one way to handle this. Give the story to the press. You get on the radio.
And have everybody who was in contact with a dead man leave town. You can't give it to the press. Now, I may be an alarmist. I may be entirely wrong about the whole matter, but I've seen this disease work. And I'm telling you, if it ever gets loose, it can spread over the entire country. And the result will be more horrible than any of you can imagine. And the key to the whole thing lies right here, now, in the next 48 hours.
That's the 1950 film Panic in the Streets. It is Movies on the Radio today. I'm here with our experts, Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies. Also with us is Priscilla Ward. So, Laura, talk about how film noir approaches talking about disease in this film.
So this is got a very different tone from one of these later outbreak films because it's almost done in kind of a semi-documentary style. There's a lot of, you know, great location footage of the docks. I think it's in New Orleans. Elia Kazan, the director, had done On the Waterfront. He was a pioneer of a more realistic style of acting. It stars Richard Widmark, who was a pretty big star at the time, although mostly for playing villains. And he plays a crusading doctor. I mean, it really is a valoration of the medical profession and how they will sort of buttress themselves between the police and the government and other people who might not understand his public health initiative.
Yeah. Okay. I want to move back forward in time now, or jump back forward to more present day, and look at how popular cinema takes a total turn in its treatment of disease in the later part of the century. We're going to play a clip from I Am Legend, and I'm going to have you respond, Priscilla.
In 2009, a deadly virus burned through our civilization, pushing humankind to the edge of extinction. Dr. Robert Neville dedicated his life to the discovery of a cure and the restoration of humanity. On September 9th, 2012, at approximately 8:49 p.m., he discovered that cure. And at 8:52, he gave his life to defend it. We are his legacy. This is his legend. Light up the darkness.
That's from the 2007 film I Am Legend. I'm here with Movies on the Radio today. Priscilla, what do you think about this kind of apocalyptic action thriller and setting something kind of after everything has taken place? It's a very different way to set up a film.
Setting it, I'm not quite sure what you're asking me. The ways in which it's apocalyptic and sort of backward looking, or?
Yeah, I mean, and what it does to the narrative to start after everything has taken place.
Right. Well, I mean, I Am Legend, obviously it puts it in a framework that makes it a legend. So this person was legendary. We now have the society that has survived. It's interesting, though, that it's based on a 1959, I think. Might have that wrong. It might be early 60s. But it's based on a novella where, in fact, the main character, Robert Neville, ends up dead, and there are no humans after him. It's completely taken over by zombies. The film has been made several times. A film was made from it. It was made several times, and they've explored different endings. And I think that there's something about the 2009 one that allows us, that suggests that we're not really interested in a film that ends truly apocalyptically. We really are interested in the renewal, renovation, and survival of humanity, and the idea that somehow we won't be defeated. Science will out.
And this is one of the first times today so far that we've really talked about zombies, and we see their presence in these films. Marcia and Laura, I know that you both have a lot of thoughts about zombies, but what do you think about the portrayal in I Am Legend?
Well, I mean, I would loop it back a little bit to the 1970s version, which was Omega Man with Charlton Heston as the doctor who's last man alive after this. Basically, again, I think the context, if I remember correctly, was it was human biological warfare that created this. And I've not read the story it's based on. But in the 1970s, there were many disaster films that came out. This is like the decade of disaster films. Andromeda Strain also, which was based on a Michael Crichton novel about contagion as well. And so that idea of like imagining civilization has ended. Now it's man against zombie or small group against zombie. That has very much come out of the 1970s and has been kind of reinvigorated in the past 10 or 20 years. I mean, I guess you could also talk about Night of the Living Dead as one of the origin films for that, since that was the first of the great contemporary zombie movies. But this idea that it's no longer about finding a cure, everything has happened, right? It's about how do you survive in the wake of the worst possible scenario happening. And so these are both, because they seem so outlandish, they can be kind of these releases of kind of adventure and heroism and, you know, being resourceful, but they are also pretty doomsday scenario in terms of what they're actually imagining.
Well, Charlton Heston was almost like a designated survivor in the 1970s, because he was the Omega Man, he was in Planet of the Apes, he was in Soylent Green. These are all extremely kind of disturbing, dystopian visions of man destroying them himself. And the most recent reboot of Planet of the Apes is also about, I think it's an Alzheimer's drug, sort of gone rogue, and creating the advanced apes with James Franco as the least believable neurobiologist ever in the history of movies. So it was a 70s thing. I mean, we were obviously feeling very depressed in the 70s.
Well, it is interesting to see these people like Will Smith playing an American virologist, as you said. I mean, the actors that we don't usually think of in those more kind of serious, very intellectually, thorough professions.
Right. I mean, I believe that, Dustin Hoffman went to college. I'm not sure about some of these other guys.
I believe Will Smith went to college. I also think it's interesting that they made him black, right? And that the character was always white, and here is now a heroic character who is a brilliant scientist, who is heroic, who gives his life to allow humanity to survive. And I want to go back, Anita, to your question about racism, because I do think there's a lot of racism in Outbreak and in the Outbreak narrative generally, which is, where do these viruses come from? They tend to come from the global south, which is not true or historic or whatever. I mean, some of them do, some of them don't. But in the narrative, they're always from that kind of place. And it is true that in Outbreak, the problem is in part because of a bioweapon, and the Donald Sutherland character, McClintock, does not want to give that away, and therefore they miss their opportunity to make a vaccine that would actually work. The virus mutates. But nonetheless, the virus comes from Africa. The opening scene is in violent Africa, where everybody's dying and diseased and the doctor doesn't know how to handle it. So I do think that there's an effort now through actors, through different kinds of plots, to try to address some of that racism. Nonetheless, we see it in the current COVID-19 pandemic, anti-Asian.
Yeah, racism. It's interesting. Right, we spoke about that. It has been weaponized. And I mean, Donald Trump tweeted in recent days, still using the narrative, the Chinese virus is still what he's calling coronavirus or COVID-19. So it does seem that, race becomes a part of this narrative still to this day, obviously, and is politicized as we talk about where things come from.
And zombies are another race, right? So, I mean, in the zombie narratives, it's built in.
Race and class.
Well,
they're the masses, the undifferentiated animalistic masses that are racialized and classed and all of those things.
Marsha, I'll let you have a minute, and then we have to take a break.
Yeah, I was just going to add that in Contagion, to me, the most chilling scene of the film comes at the end, which is where it reveals where the disease comes from, which is images of a bat giving it to a pig, giving it to a chef, butchering it in a restaurant in Asia, to Gwyneth Paltrow getting exposed to it by taking a photo with the chef, and then she becomes the point of contact to the West. And so that film also brokers in that same idea.
This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. It's Movies on the Radio today, and we are talking about how Hollywood handles pandemics and disease on the screen. IRL, the coronavirus pandemic, is causing a lot of real-world chaos for the film industry. South by Southwest and the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival in Durham have both been canceled, and movie theaters have shut their doors to prevent the spread of COVID-19. So what does all of this mean for filmmakers, theaters, and the industry in North Carolina? Emily Cass is the executive director of the Chelsea Theater in Chapel Hill, and she joins me now. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tell me about what's going on with the Chelsea. You all recently decided to close your doors. What does that mean for the theater and your business?
Well, we are closed until May 15th following the current guidelines, so 2 months, basically. And what that means is while we're shut down, we still have to protect, you know, our asset, our theater, our projectors, and so on, and maintain our fixed costs. We also have to keep the engagement up with our audiences, and so that they'll come back after we reopen. So there are lots of ways we're thinking about doing that.
What does that engagement look like? Because people, you know, they do have still have access to films on TV, Netflix, other streaming platforms. So what do you do to kind of maintain that relationship to make them aware that, you know, as a community space and as a space to gather in community to watch films, you're still going to be there?
Well, like a lot of business, we're just going to a virtual place. So whether starting with our newsletter, which is has an extensive number of people subscribe to it, so we'll be ramping up our frequency of that, providing more and different and interesting content that, you know, certainly not at all to replace the movie-going experience, but perhaps doing some things like, you know, discussion groups, webinars, podcasts, even looking into are there any proprietary subscription services that we can tie into that will give our audience some content until we reopen.
Are you in conversations with other independent theaters around the country? Is there any sense of community there for you?
Oh, definitely. There's a wonderful organization called Art House Convergence, which is a national network of art house theaters, much like ours, and of course larger. And we are starting to have more frequent conference calls that any of us can link into to discuss issues, whether it's resources, programming, education. Unfortunately or fortunately, what we're going through here in North Carolina affected theaters on the West Coast first, so we can, and other areas, so we can look to, you know, our peers in those places for guidance on what they did that works and so forth.
You all also are intentional about creating a space for independent filmmakers. So what kind of conversations are you having with them about, you know, ways to continue to promote and support their work?
Well, that's a really good question. That's something that we are just beginning to explore. And, you know, truthfully, I'm really focusing on what we have to do to, you know, close at the moment. But I think being able to showcase, you know, really new independent filmmakers who don't have distribution, so we may, in some strange way, be able to bring more and new content to people than we would have just in the confines of our four walls.
Emily Cass is the executive director of the Chelsea Theater in Chapel Hill. Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you.
So still with me are our Movies on the Radio experts, Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys. Also still with us is English professor Priscilla Wald. So Marcia and Laura, I know you both are very involved in the independent film scene here. So talk about, Laura, maybe let's start with you, what your reactions are to the hit that this is going to be for the film business and the film industry.
Well, to begin with, I think the fears that people will get so used to streaming that they'll never go back to a theater again is wrong, because everyone is trapped in their houses. I think the desire for community is really going to be strong once this episode is over. And I also wanted to mention that not just theaters like the Carolina, where I show my film series as well, but my daughter, who works as a tailor in New York on film and TV productions, wants you to remember that as you're binge-watching your Netflix shows, that every single one of those persons who made them are now unemployed. And for a freelancer like her, the unions are trying to get some sort of compensation for their freelancers, but they are left out of many of these kinds of coronavirus unemployment bills because they're considered to be independent contractors.
Right. And Marcia, I mean, thinking about Full Frame Documentary Film Festival being canceled and it being a space where documentary artists who, you know, their films are not always big money makers have a space to really get attention to their work.
Yeah, I mean, this has just completely devastated the film festival circuit. Every single film festival has been canceled or postponed. you know, optimistically postponed, since we have no idea how long it will be before it's safe to schedule a film festival. Some festivals are doing some really creative things, like putting their content online, some for a subscription cost and some for, you know, for free just to share with the public. But I mean, I think the idea of, and this is happening in every industry imaginable, right? All of a sudden the plug has just been pulled out all at once. Distributors are pushing back releases. Studios are scrambling to figure out how to deliver their releases online. Production has come to pretty much a halt as far as I can tell, from talking to people in Los Angeles and New York, where everything is either canceled or postponed indefinitely. And so I think the ripple effects of this go from the small independent filmmaker all the way to the big studio, and nobody knows what's going to happen.
All right. Well, we'll stay tuned to that as everything continues. But let's return now to our analysis of disease in cinema. And let's actually start with a documentary. Let's start with the 2012 documentary, How to Survive a Plague. And here's a clip from that featuring an activist-led funeral march on New York City.
A political funeral for Mark Fisher, who wouldn't let us burn or bury his courage or his love for us any more than he would let the earth take his body until it was already in flight. He asked for this ceremony not so we could bury him, but so we could celebrate his undying anger. This isn't a political funeral for Mark. It's a political funeral for the man who killed him and so many others, and is slowly killing me, whose name curls my tongue and curdles my breath. George Bush, we believe you'll be defeated tomorrow because we believe there's still some justice left in the universe and some compassion left in the American people. But whether or not you are here and now standing by Mark's body, we put this curse on you. Mark's spirit will haunt you until the end of your days, so that in the moment of your defeat, you'll remember our defeats, and in the moment of your death, you'll remember our deaths.
So that was a clip from the 2012 documentary, How to Survive a Plague, documenting ACT UP, which is an activist organization that was advocating for the recognition of the HIV/AIDS crisis. They were marching on the New York City Republican National Committee headquarters in advance of the 1992 presidential election. Priscilla, I'd love to start with you on this one. This is the first documentary that we have discussed up to now. Tell me about what you think about this nonfiction portrayal of disease.
I thought it was magnificent. As someone who spent the 80s in New York, I watched that pandemic, unfold with horror, lost friends and loved ones. And I thought it was extremely sensitive, beautiful, wonderfully filmed, and I'll let the film experts speak more to that. But I often find in documentaries there's kind of a talking head that floats across the screen, and these talking heads were so human. They were in their environment. I didn't feel that they were disembodied people reminiscing. They were really people who were bringing their full lives, contemporary lives, to the memory of what they had lived through. And one of the things that I thought was excellent about the film was that it gave you both the perspective of people who were extremely frustrated with a government that really was not putting the resources into this pandemic that they should have been, and were not allowing people who were facing death to speed up the testing process, all of that. At the same time, you see at the end some of the people who survived saying, well, we weren't entirely right either. The government was, or the CDC, the WHO, some of these organizations really were right about the need for testing and the need to slow it down a little bit. So you get a wonderfully balanced perspective that gets the full message across, and I thought it was beautiful.
Laura, yeah, what about the filmmaking of that one?
Well, I'd like to speak to something a little different, which is that documentaries have a very particular power, and they play to a particular audience. But one thing that was, I I think very influential in the whole AIDS epidemic was Philadelphia, where Tom Hanks, you know, America's favorite actor, became the face of AIDS. For better or for worse, there were, you know, problems with the film, and it hasn't aged particularly well. But having a person that you could really identify with brought it sort of to a broader kind of consciousness throughout the film watching community.
You're talking about the 1993 American legal drama film Philadelphia.
Yes.
Marcia?
And oddly enough, Tom Hanks in the real world has played that role today, because he was the first high-profile actor to come out and say he had been diagnosed with COVID in Australia and had been exposed.
I thought that was an extraordinary coincidence that he probably wished he could have passed on.
Well,
yes,
and many people
absolutely.
Were calling that our Rock Hudson moment.
I mean,
talk more about that, Marcia.
Well, I mean, I do think that for better or for worse, we live in a culture that values celebrity in disproportionate ways. And so to have a much beloved, good guy actor who does wonderful things on behalf of veterans and social issues become the first major celebrity to be afflicted with this had an impact that unfortunately hundreds or maybe thousands of other cases did not have. And so, you know, maybe we need to take our wake-up calls wherever we can get them. But I think that I think that was a pivot point when I saw the media coverage of that. Things seemed to kind of shift after that. And so, I think it was a significant moment in this current unfolding story.
Priscilla, I know you think a lot about stigma and the role of stigma in preventing good public health measures, something we see a bit in Philadelphia, the stigma around Tom Hanks' character. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I guess I'm a slightly dissenting voice on this, because I found that film, even when I saw it, overly sentimental and unbelievable. And I didn't think it really got at the rawness of the pandemic in the way that something like How to Survive a Plague does, and even some of the more fictional portrayals do. But I do think that it did a good job showing the stigma. And I do remember how Rock Hudson, years after the government should have been paying attention, how Rock Hudson turned Ronald Reagan's attention to the pandemic. And I want to think that we would be quicker at the draw at this point.
All right. I want to play one more clip to close out our conversation. This is from the 2013 biopic Dallas Buyers Club.
Mr. Woodruff, would you kindly tell us what you're doing?
Oh, I'm just giving people information, Richard, at this trial I'm in, to make sure they know what's going on.
What is going on?
Why'd you cut off peptide T, Richard? Huh? Non-toxic drug that I got proof works, and that the National Institute of Mental Health, your own people, say is completely safe.
Mr. Woodruff, I'm afraid that you are nothing more than a common drug dealer, so if you'll excuse us, we would like...
Oh, I'm the drug dealer. Now, you're the drug dealer. I mean, people are dying, and y'all are all up there afraid that we're going to find an alternative without you. See, the pharma companies pay the FDA to push their product. No, they don't want to see my research.
All right.
I don't have enough cash in my pocket to make it worth their while.
It's enough.
That's it right there. I'll tell you what, I'm going to be a pain in your ass when I'm 6 feet under.
Let's go.
Maybe one day you'll get off your ass and do your job.
I need you to leave. Let's go.
Here, pass these around, would you? Here.
That's a clip from the 2013 biopic Dallas Buyers Club, starring Matthew McConaughey as Ron Woodruff. It's Movies on the Radio today, here with Priscilla Wald, Marcia Gordon, and Laura Boies. So you have an incredible Matthew McConaughey in that film, a different take on the HIV/AIDS epidemic, an interesting kind of character to follow throughout the whole thing. We don't have much time left, but I'd love to close with y'all's thoughts on that one.
I thought it was wonderful, again, and I loved the way the character changed, right? The character, talk about stigma, the character starts out homophobic and macho and unsympathetic, and as he copes with the fact of being HIV positive, he becomes more compassionate, he becomes more political, he becomes much more sympathetic. So really showing that arc, I thought, was really quite magnificent of someone who found himself in a very different community from the one with which he began.
Laura?
I think
America needs a hero. I mean, that's what this film is saying, what all of these films are saying. We want somebody with a strong moral center, regardless of how they got there, to step in and tell us what we need to do.
Although, isn't he more ambiguous than that because of how he starts out? I totally agree with you, but there's also a sense in which he's a very crusty and unusual and initially very hard to sympathize with hero, and that at least gave some texture to that.
Well, and also because that appeals to all of the people who need to change their own minds in the audience about how they feel about AIDS. He's definitely a character that brings the audience through that particular character arc. I mean, Denzel Washington is that same character in a way in Philadelphia, where he starts out, you know, so homophobic and against everything, and then he has to come around. I mean, that allows the audience to change their mind during the course of the film.
Marcia, we only have 15 seconds for your response.
Well, I just want to say, in terms of what it does to a narrative, HIV is a very different disease to use because it spreads quietly as opposed to these narratives of like rampant contagion. So it's just a very different disease to use in terms of storytelling.
And because we still don't have a cure.
There you go. Much more to talk about all of these films. Thank you so much to our guests, Laura Boyes, Marcia Gordon, and Priscilla Wald. You can find out more about all of them and all of the movies we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Amanda Magnus and Grant Hall of Mormon. Josie Tarris is our intern. Lindsay Foster Thomas helped out today. Jenny Lawson is a technical director. The State of Things is from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.